This first actuality has to do with a plan to aid Alaska Natives. He says he believes that many issues involve mental health. He says there's a need for internal federal coordination between the BIA and the Department of Health and Human Services, and he plans to push that agenda at the AFN meeting in October. This cut runs a minute and 18 seconds, and the out cue is responsibilities that we have in Alaska. It's 1:18, it's coming down in 3, 2, 1.
As I understand some of the issues, many of them involve a lot of mental health issues that clearly, you know, involve health and human services. I think, you know, it behooves us to begin to work and communicate with HHS in regards to those needs and coordinate to ensure that those, you know, looking at some of the recent studies down there, you look at the mental health, whether it's suicide rate, domestic violence, many of those relate to a lot of the mental health kinds of issues. That's one. The other is that I think that there needs to be some continued dialogue in the role of the Bureau within the state of Alaska. One of the things I'm looking forward to is hopefully in October, if we can get the legislative agenda and the worked out, that I would hope to be up in Alaska at the Federation meeting in October to meet with the groups and to have some greater discussion in regards to the role and function of the Bureau and what the needs are and just how well equipped we are in providing or carrying out the responsibilities that we have in Alaska.
Okay, the second cut is in response to a question from Gary on the role of the BIA in the whole question of sovereignty. This cut is 56 seconds in which Eddie Brown says that he doesn't know, that he is up here to find out, and that he will reserve judgment on the question. The out cue is at this point in time, and the cut runs 56 seconds. It's coming down in 3, 2, 1.
That's one of the reasons I want to go up there and visit. That's one of the reasons why I want to take a look at the other issues. I've been on board 30 days here, or a little over 30 days. I know just from my past experience that the issues with Alaska Natives are very complex and have a long historical development in that regard. One of the things I want to do is take some time and take a look at the issue, understand what the situation is, particularly historically here within the Bureau, and looking at the different settlements that are going on in Alaska, as well as looking at Congress. And until I'm able to have a little more information and have a little better handle on all of that information in regards to the issue, I'm going to reserve making any judgment at this point in time.
Okay, item three is a question in response to a question on the administration's view on the needs of Alaska. It's a cut that runs a minute, 8 seconds. Brown is responding that the administration is aware of the needs, but the question is how to work with the system, within the system, and the situation to do the job. He says it'll take time and dialogue with Alaska Natives. He's hoping for more direct communication with Alaska Natives. This cut runs a minute and 8 seconds. The out cue is have good dialogue. It's coming down in 3, 2, 1.
In regards to this administration's view on the needs of Alaska, one of the things that had come up most recently is, you know, whether or not this administration is aware that there are needs in Alaska. And let me assure you that we are certainly aware that there are needs in Alaska. The question then becomes on how do we address them, what process is put in place. And I guess I'm very concerned, given, as we talked about, the history of it, the politics of it, of how we ensure that there is no question about the need of Alaska Natives. And the question then comes in as how do we work with the system that we've got, given the historical, the political, and the resources we have, to best address that. And I think that's going to take some dialogue and some discussion and some good open communication. And, as Assistant Secretary, I'm hoping that that communication can be there, that we can put things on the table, that we can talk directly to one another, and that we can lay out what's possible and what isn't possible, and that we have good dialogue.
3, 2, 1. The system is called ABI Inform, and it's making some research go much more quickly. The library got the software on a trial basis last March. The addition of a new format to it, called CD-ROM, will eventually make looking through the reader's guide obsolete. In the CD-ROM format, ABI Inform can access more than 800 business and management journals. At the Rasmussen Library, just fewer than half of those articles can be tracked down through the computer and printed in just minutes, all at your desk. No searching through library shelves to see if the article is there or even if it's what you're looking for. And you can bring up the article or abstract on your computer screen to check it out first. Library Director Paul McCarthy says the CD-ROM system is not only a time saver, it's also a money saver.
Before, when a student or faculty member wanted to use ABI Inform, we would have to go online for the indexing, pay a line charge of about $114 an hour, and you could do the search. The advantage for having the CD-ROM is that comparatively we could afford to provide, say, an hour a week to students or faculty on an online basis, but now can, for this, about the same price, provide access to almost the same database for about 90 hours a week. So comparatively, it's a terrific value.
And it's simple to use. Bill Smith is an old hand at using the new system, but he says students can learn how to use the system in just a few minutes. It tells you what to do as you go along, and Smith says conducting a search is easy because the computer will look for the information you need no matter how you ask for it.
You can search a variety of methods using just a phrase. You can search by company name, you can search by personal author, you can search by there that has a coding system, you can find a citation, and if it is in a subject area and it gives codes, you can search by a code, which is a very shortcut method of searching. It's a whole variety of flexibility of ways of searching the database.
The computer packs in periodical citations over the last 5 years. The ABI Inform runs through all of those citations much more quickly than anyone can do manually. Library Director McCarthy estimates that it searches about 100 citations a second. He compares it to eating potato chips. Once you take just a taste of what the computer will do, you want to keep going because you just can't stop. McCarthy says the ABI Inform now cuts business research time considerably. In the course of just a few minutes, you can run through the citations on any given subject, and at least 3 out of 8 should be available immediately at the Rasmussen Library. You can leave with several articles in hand in the time it might normally take to let your fingers do the walking through the reader's guide. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Last year. Now, we are a nonprofit corporation, so of course we never plan to make very much money. But of course, the weather has great impact, you know, and if we should happen to get heavy rains both weekends, that would be rather serious for us. But we're optimistic that we're going to do well this year. That work for other organizations.
3, 2, 1. Cloudy skies over Fairbanks kept us in the dark at about 1 o'clock Sunday morning, but that's when researchers at Poker Flats put a rocket in the air to create a cloud. Poker Flats Science Director Dr. Charles Deer.
A rocket was fired from Poker Flat. It went up to about 300 kilometers, and it fired small particles down. And these proved effective as nucleating agents at the 100-kilometer altitude to make a cloud. You need small nuclei to make clouds. All clouds are formed that way. And we used these nuclei to make the clouds and created, essentially, artificial clouds.
The artificial cloud scientists want to learn more about was a noctilucent cloud, the kind that only exists in polar regions. Noctilucent clouds are so high up they are only visible when the sun is at a certain angle below the horizon, when you can see the cloud but not the ground. Deere says by making an artificial noctilucent cloud, scientists can find out more about what goes on that high up in the atmosphere. Sunday morning's rocket launch was actually the second of two. The first one occurred on July 24th, but Deere says then it was cloudy south of Fairbanks and too light here to see the activity. What happened on Sunday morning did not go unnoticed, though. In Kodiak, the rocket made quite an impression. Deere says the rocket may have been visible from 500 miles away, but there was no cause for alarm.
It's not a very large amount of explosive, and it's certainly not anything dangerous. And in fact, there are no environmental effects at all of just a little charge like this. And I was surprised at the descriptions of from Kodiak of the size of this fireball. But it would certainly have been visible from Fairbanks had there not been clouds.
Deere says the rocket launchings were being observed by a number of groups around Alaska to record the position, altitude, and changes in the cloud. The results will be analyzed over the next year. Deere says research on noctilucent clouds has been done at Poker Flats on and off for the last 25 years, but this was the first time they had the opportunity to create an artificial cloud. He says the artificial cloud is different from a real noctilucent cloud, but the results of the tests must be reviewed to see what the differences are. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
I'm just a good old 60-year-old Alaskan grandpa that wants to see our state grow, stabilize, and be home for the future generations.
Hospital. Alaska doctors are now performing surgery learned from their colleagues in the Soviet Far East. That's according to Mike Holloway, an orthopedic surgeon at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. Holloway says he started studying the technique for treating fractures 2 years ago and began practicing it a year ago. He says he and Dr. Bill Payton at the Alaska Native Medical Center are the only two Alaska doctors now using the so-called Ilizarov technique. Holloway says a Siberian doctor in the 1950s originated the technique of healing fractures in cases where parts of bones become destroyed.
Basically uses very small pins and drills them through the bones, through the leg, and then fixes them into an apparatus that's outside of the leg. It's rather bulky and even a little medieval in appearance, but it's you then fix these pins into these rings and tension them just like you would a bicycle spoke or a motorcycle spoke, and so you gain a great deal of strength out of them, and you can control bone and fractures and even lengthen bone.
Holloway concedes the apparatus is bulky, but he says it enables patients to walk almost completely without the help of doctors.
For bones that fail to heal, we used to have to remove bone from their pelvis or hip area and open the site and clean it out and put bone graft in and use some type of metal to fix it inside. Now we merely put these on the outside without even opening the area that hasn't healed, and just gradually press it together, and it all heals. Now, I've done in the last year about 8 people with that problem. Every one of them is healed without having to have a more major surgery. So we're very pleased and hope to continue learning more and using it more and more.
Holloway says American doctors let patients go home soon after the treatment, but Soviet doctors keep their patients in hospitals for up to 4 or 5 months after the treatment. Holloway says he learned the technique from Itakinti Irilov, a Magadan doctor. He says Irilov came to Alaska for 3 weeks to teach Alaskans more about the technique. Holloway also consulted with Irilov during a 3-week visit to the eastern USSR last month. According to Holloway, rural doctors can use the technique in cases where shotgun blasts actually destroy parts of bones. Urban doctors can use the technique often during auto accidents that destroy parts of bones. In Kotzebue, I'm Jeff Kennedy.
3, 2, 1. Borough Mayor Juanita Helms and Sister City Commissioner Mimi Chapin went to Yakutsk in June. After the visit, they extended an invitation to the Soviets to come here. Now they are. The mayor of Yakutsk and 2 others will be here for nearly 10 days, and the local Sister City Commission is trying to involve the community in lining up things for the Russians to do. Mimi Chapin is one of the people initially interested in finding a Soviet sister city. Chapin sees the sister city relationship as a way to communicate with another city on a long-term basis.
Instead of a short, once-over tourist kind of approach towards communication, you try to develop a long-term relationship with a city. You get to know the mayor, the mayor's children, the mayor's family, the doctors and lawyers' children and families, and what happens to them. And this is the kind of history that you find when you talk to people that have been involved in other cities, sister cities projects from around the country.
One of the interesting things about establishing a sister city relationship with Yakutsk is how much the two cities have in common. Yakutsk is a large industrial city in the Soviet Far East, about the same latitude as Anchorage. But like Fairbanks, it's an interior city on a river. It has a university and a sizable native population. It also has extreme climates, isolation, and annual changes in the amount of daylight. The Sister City Committee has been busy planning things for the Soviets to see while they're here. Mayor Helm says they'll be kept busy.
They're going to be here in time to experience the fair a little bit. We have people that are going to be from the school district that are going to be showing them a little bit around, at least around Lathrop and maybe some of the other schools. We've got receptions planned, and there's going to be some travel, we hope, like to Circle Hot Springs, to Denali, so they can see a little bit more of the state.
Both Helms and Chapin want the Soviets to leave here with the same feelings they left Yakutsk with.
Both the amazement that there's so many similarities in our two countries. They're at the same latitude as we are, and the vegetation and everything around Yakutsk is like Fairbanks. And the similarities in the people. We were treated so warmly and so well when we were there. I want them to have the same impression with Fairbanks.
Juanita said it all pretty well. Our location makes us have a certain attitude towards life that you don't have when you're living in the middle of New York City or Los Angeles. And when we were in Yakutsk or with spending time with the Yakutians, we felt a tremendous bond of understanding about certain things that we didn't need to even talk about, and I hope that they'll sense that from being here in Fairbanks.
The three Soviets from Yakutsk will leave at the end of August. After that, there will still be a lot of discussion before the sister city arrangement would actually be finalized. Helm says there will be months of discussion on both sides because both groups are very cautious about long-term commitments. And she says there will probably be another invitation to visit, but the next time she hopes the most direct travel route could be taken. This group of Soviets is arriving via New York. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornton.
Function. We have a whole series of people that are coming from federal agencies and from major international companies that do purchase substantial amounts of goods and services to perform government contracts. And as a result of the conference we held here two or three years ago, and in Anchorage, there were several businessmen who did find out how to get involved and have increased their sales to the government and our government contractors. So I hope.
Jobs, the Job Opportunities and Basic Skills Program, was part of the Welfare Reform Act signed into law last October. Alaska Native organizations were given the chance to apply for funding to start their own jobs program, and the Tanana Chiefs Conference did. TCC Director of Employment and Training Donna Scott says the initial $20,000 grant is based on the number of adult Natives on welfare in the Doyon region. She says it will be used to get the program started.
We will be working on job search with those clients, and we'll be working on employability development plans where we sit down with them and actually start targeting the types of activities that will eventually get them off of public assistance and into the private public workforce, unsubsidized work.
In October, Scott says the Tanana Chiefs should get more than $100,000 as full funding. Scott says they plan to make sure that the training and work experience to be offered will translate into jobs.
Right now, in administering our other programs, we're often looking at up to an 85% unemployment rate out in some of our villages. So in all of our programs that we run, it's always something that we have to contend with. A lot of people have to move into town, Fairbanks or Anchorage, in order to obtain work. And that is something that we have been trying to work on in administering our other grants. And we will be working with local employers, of whom there are not very many, but we will be working with those school districts, village councils and city councils, and trying to get the employment that is required in order to make this work.
Targeted populations for the jobs program include anyone who has received aid to families with dependent children for 3 of the last 5 years, parents without a high school diploma and little or no work experience, and families with the youngest child close to being ineligible for aid. Scott says child care will be provided, and part of the provisions of the Welfare Reform Act will keep those families eligible for child care and Medicaid for as much as a year after they have found employment. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. The Job Opportunities and Basic Skills Program is part of the Welfare Reform Act signed into law last October. Alaska Native organizations were given the chance to apply for funding to start their own jobs program, and the Tanana Chiefs Conference did. TCC Director of Employment and Training Donna Scott says the initial $20,000 grant will be used as startup funding to get the word out to potential clients.
And then we will be working on job search with those clients, and we'll be working on employability development plans where we sit down with them and actually start targeting the types of activities that will eventually get them off of public assistance and into the private workforce.
In October, the Tanana Chiefs Conference expects to get more than $100,000 as full funding. Scott says with unemployment in the villages as high as 85%, they plan to make sure that the training and work experience to be offered will translate into jobs.
We will be working with those school districts, village councils and city councils, and trying to get the employment that is required in order to make this work.
People without high school diplomas and those long dependent on welfare have been targeted for the Tanana Chiefs job program. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. A charred skeletal structure is all that remains of the old Coliseum. It was one of the fairgrounds' landmarks. Food booths that were permanently attached to the Coliseum's south side are also gone. Deputy State Fire Marshal Edith Curry believes that one of those food booths is where the fire began. Curry spent her morning digging through the debris and says it looks like an Indian food booth called the Himalayan had set up some sort of oven in a 55-gallon drum. Curry says the drum was lined with clay and concrete.
You can see on the floor over here where the drum sat up on two bricks, but it was fairly close to the wall there, and it appears that just the radiant heat from the drum itself ignited not only the floor underneath it, but the entire wall next to it, and the fire built up there, went up and hit the ceiling and just flashed across both directions, taking the whole thing down.
Propane lines were nearby, and when the fire burned through those lines, it caused a burst of flames. Fairground Security Officer Nolan Roy was trying to track down the smell of smoke at about 5:15 a.m., and he was standing nearby.
It looked like a big cloud of smoke and flames that went up about 50 feet in the air. Just like a bomb exploding.
State Fair Manager Carl Amstrup and Fair Board Member Alan Schoen surveyed the damage as fire crews cleared away debris.
What would you say, Alan? Quarter of a million?
Well, the structure itself is, yeah, it's probably maximum insurance loss for the whole thing. As far as contents, as I understand, it's going to be pretty well maxed out, too, with some of the equipment down there, snowmobile and four-wheeler and the sound system we lost entirely, so.
Minimum of a quarter of a million, you know.
It's all gone.
Yeah, it's shot.
Amstrup says the Coliseum was one of the most familiar buildings on the fairgrounds.
It was an old building. It was also a traditional building on the fairgrounds. People that have been here for many years, of course. When you refer to the Coliseum, just about everybody knows what building it is. We're going to sorely miss it, but we're fortunate in that nobody was in and around. There's no nobody hurt, then that's, of course, always the first concern.
Fair workers roped off what was left of the building and then spent the day clearing away debris and rerouting fairgoers. Amstrup is rescheduling some of the events that were scheduled for the Coliseum in the remaining days of the fair, but he wants to also make sure that the fair goes on. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. Officials with the Fairbanks North Star Borough want a Soviet sister city. They invited Yakutsk officials here as part of the courtship process. The three Russians will have a busy schedule, visiting schools, local businesses, and attending receptions in their honor. Borough Mayor Juanita Helms wants them to leave Fairbanks, feeling that the two cities could have a great relationship.
With the impression of the real endless possibilities that exist here between our two communities in the different exchanges that we can have and the benefits that we can both get from them.
Even after the Yakutsk visitors leave on August 29th, it will take months of discussion before the two communities decide whether or not to become sister cities. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson.
I've outlived most chamber executives in tenure in that regard anyway. And there are some other things that I would like to do. This is pretty all-consuming kind of a job. And I need a little respite for myself. There's some other things I want to explore. And so we've had a number of successes, and I just decided that was time.
I smelt some smoke, didn't see no flames whatsoever. So about 20 minutes after, came around and saw a big cloud of black smoke, and it exploded.
It appears that whatever the business was here had a large 55-gallon drum that they've converted into some type of a stove or an oven-type thing. It's has some type of a clay lining in it, and then they've poured concrete around this clay liner and filled it with briquettes. Mm. And you can see on the floor over here where the drum sat up on two bricks, but it was fairly close to the wall there, and it appears that just the radiant heat from the drum itself ignited not only the floor underneath it, but the entire wall next to it, and the fire built up there, went up and hit the ceiling and just flashed across both directions, taking the whole thing down.
It was an old building. It was also a traditional building on the fairgrounds. People that have been here for many years, of course. When you refer to the Coliseum, just about everybody knows what building it is. It's the one that had the stage, and it's the one that where we had programs and we could seat 500 people in there. And so we're going to sorely miss it, but we're fortunate in that nobody was in and around. Nobody hurt, and that's, of course, always the first concern.
After 2 days of negotiations on side issues, the administration and the Alaska State Employees Association remain far apart on the big money questions, that is, a wage increase the union wants and a cap on health benefit costs that the state is seeking. When neither side budged on those points, Diane Corso, the state's chief negotiator, declared an impasse and said she would seek help from a federal mediator for those general government workers who by law cannot strike. The union's chief negotiator, Don Wasserman, said he and others would remain at the table. Wasserman said he'll be there next week, ready to negotiate. But under a Supreme Court ruling, the Cooper administration is allowed to impose contract terms on state workers when the talks break down. For now, it appears that's the case. Next week, both sides appear before the State Labor Relations Agency to argue about unfair labor practice charges each has filed against the other. This round of talks had been scheduled to last until the end of August. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Thank you all very much.
At the conclusion of that schedule, which occurs in November, a bond issue would come before the assembly. That bond issue would go to the voters. It might be $1 million, $5 million, $10 million. It might be Old Main School. It might not. I do not think that we should muddy the waters by putting something on just to have something on and then be stuck with the something that might not be what the study shows to be the best choice. I think we should wait for the study and therefore should eliminate all of these proposals and start clean.
What we are here today to announce is a major lawsuit, but what we are here today to achieve is to try to bring the environment back to where it was before the Exxon Valdez spill.
Three solar flares released this week are the largest recorded in 17 years. According to the Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks, the flares released a great deal of energy in various forms of radiation. As this energy reaches the polar region of the Earth's atmosphere, it causes oxygen, nitrogen, and other molecules to glow. Each molecule glows its own color, and this is what we see in the form of aurora. The Sitka Observatory expects the energy to reach its peak levels this weekend, resulting in brilliant displays of northern lights. Bob Hunsucker is a geophysicist at the Geophysical Institute. He says the solar flares will interfere with navigation devices as well as short and medium radio waves.
There will be all kinds of bizarre propagation at nighttime of radio broadcasting, standard AM broadcast.
He adds that satellite communication could be disturbed as well. In Sitka, this is Lisa Bush.
There's a lot more folks working than there were a year ago, and there's a lot of folks that have left town to work in other areas of the state, too, notably the Gulf Coast area for the spill cleanup.
This actually is the same organization that tried for Willow Creek to do the ski run up there, and the mining community decided that they didn't think skiing was compatible with mining. So this is an alternative that we've come up with. It's entirely borough-owned land, which makes it makes us able to be able to deal with the ski people. I certainly hope not. This fulfills the purpose that everybody talks about in trying to develop winter tourism attractions, besides the fact that you want to be able to entertain yourself during the winter. But it could enhance the tourist trade for the area almost into a year-round.
Do they have a timetable?
3, 2, 1. Attorney Bill Satterberg says there is no question that his client was intoxicated when police arrested him last March, but there is some question about how Richard Purdy was treated by his arresting officer. Purdy suffered a fractured hand and has had it operated on. He's been unable to work because of the injury. Attorney Satterberg says that Purdy was struck by the arresting officer with a flashlight. Satterberg says that Purdy did resist arrest, but was not violent, and he believes the force used was unnecessary. Satterberg asked the city council last night to give the case a closer look.
At this point, we're asking for basically two things. We're asking for compensation for Richard for the personal injuries which he suffered. And we're also asking, I think equally importantly, that the city take a very serious look at why this whole incident occurred. We maintain that there was no reason why the officer could not have awaited the arrival of backup and not have engaged in the activity which took place. So we're asking the city to take a look at their training programs. We're asking them to take a look at their screening programs. We're asking them to take a look at whether or not there's any racism which is coming down in the department, how they're treating people who are under the influence of alcohol, and basically to make sure that doesn't happen in the future. This is not the first incident where people have been subject to alleged abuse by the police department.
Satterberg says he appealed directly to the council because he feels that negotiations on a settlement have reached an impasse. City Attorney Herb Cuss agrees and is advising the council accordingly.
We discussed the nature of the impasse with the council in an executive session, and council did make certain decisions, but because they were made in an executive session, I just can't make those public.
Satterberg isn't specific about the amount of damages he wants from the city, but says between lost employment and medical bills, Purdy is out more than $50,000 now. His hand won't be healed for at least another 3 months if the healing process goes well. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
If the weather cooperates, Prince William Sound may be the focus of President Bush's visit. At least Senator Ted Stevens is planning it that way. The Alaska Republican heads back to Prince William Sound in a week or so with federal scientists in tow. This to recommend which of the more than 300 miles of beaches contaminated there by the oil spill that Bush should see. A June visit to the Sound by Vice President Quayle was nearly washed out by inclement weather, and Stevens says a mid-September helicopter tour of Prince William Sound by the president and his entourage of aides and news reporters will depend heavily on the weather.
But we're hopeful we'll get good weather, and I'm hopeful that he will be able to see some of the beaches that have been cleaned, some that we think have not been cleaned, and generally see the condition of the Sound.
Stevens says it's never easy to carve 3 days out of a presidential calendar for a trip exclusively to Alaska, so Bush may stop over in several other states coming and going. That will leave him with just a day and a night inside the state, 30 hours perhaps, for a whirlwind visit sandwiched between long hours on Air Force One.
It is a three-day trip to go to the Prince William Sound for summer from Washington. Having made that trip so often, I can tell them exactly what they're going to face and how much time they'll have when they get here.
Stevens, though, is hoping to arrange a little time for the president to pursue one of his favorite hobbies while he's here, that is, to go fishing, something Bush is pictured often doing off his vacation home in Kennebunkport, Maine.
And I'd like to see him catch a fish. I see him fishing all the time, but I haven't seen a fish in the other end of those poles yet, so I'd like to see him catch a fish.
Stevens says he'll be touring Prince William Sound on the 30th and 31st of this month to develop recommendations for beaches that can qualify for a possible presidential stopover. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
And could do better.
The project would be a $8 to $10 million project for Alaska, probably leaving between a quarter and a third of that total amount in the state. They're going to be hiring approximately 1,000 extras. They're going to need everything from equipment to caterers to everything. Helicopter, there's like 6 or 7 days of helicopter work on this project. So it's a big film that we are very anxious to have done here.
Fairbanks Memorial Hospital opened its doors today on what it hopes will be a successful new venture, childcare. But this new program isn't for the general public. Instead, it's exclusively designed for the hospital's employees. In fact, it's the first employer-sponsored childcare facility in Fairbanks. Sandy Hasselberger, Director of Human Resources for the hospital, says there are many mothers or potential mothers on staff at Fairbanks Memorial. The trial program is designed to meet their needs and their often unpredictable schedules. She also points out that the new facility will make the hospital more attractive to potential employees.
When you can also offer a child care center so convenient to the hospital and at competitive rates with the rest of the child care centers in town, and also a quality child care center, then that is a big motivator for a lot of people to work for us rather than for possibly a clinic or somewhere else in town.
The child care program is the result of an 18-month-long planning period, says Hasselberger. The hospital began to examine the issue after employees expressed frustration in finding adequate child care during the late night hours many of them worked. A task force was formed, comprised of management, staff, and an outside consultant who specializes in early child care and child care facilities. Their examination was focused on two questions. Was there a real need for child care on the part of the employees, and could the hospital afford the service? While the staff reaction was enthusiastic, the question remained, can Fairbanks Memorial Hospital afford the child care facility? They've given the program a year to prove itself. As Hasselberger points out, running the program will not be cheap.
This is a very risky venture. Child care is not a money-making business. For the most part, we had to make sure that if we took on this program that it would not result in raising costs to our patients in any way.
The biggest cost so far has been in finding an appropriate building. Fire codes and state regulations prevent the hospital itself being the site. All child care facilities must be located on the ground level. As luck would have it, they found a building designed as a child care facility only 8 blocks from the hospital. Another expense is the staffing of the facility. The center will run nearly round the clock for the employees, 18 hours in all, and that means hiring quality child care givers for those hours. But even given these expenses, Hasselberger is confident of the program's success. She points out that the charges to employees are competitive with other child care centers, and she expects the facility will be well used. And Sally DeWitt, head of marketing for the hospital, is quick to contradict anyone suggesting that patient care might suffer because of the new program's expense.
It may sound a little odd, but if you think through it completely, you'll come to the conclusion that if we can attract and retain qualified staff, and we can bring staff in when patients need them, then we're going to be able to offer a higher level of patient care in our hospital. And we've determined that we can do that by offering child care services to our employees.
But whatever the eventual fate of this program, new ground has been broken in Fairbanks. In fact, DeWitt says that other businesses have approached Fairbanks Memorial Hospital about employer-sponsored daycare.
Hopefully, we are setting a trend for businesses in Fairbanks. We are not the only organization that's going to need to find other ways to bring in new employees and keep them over time.
For KUAC Local News in Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. The Interior Taxpayers Association proposed changing how the hotel-motel tax is allocated. The Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau currently gets 70% of the bed tax to promote tourism. The ITA initiative would have instead put most of the money into the city's general fund. With more than 600 signatures, the initiative was submitted to the city and certified for the October ballot. But the attorney for the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau sent a letter to the city this week challenging the constitutionality of the initiative and threatening legal action if the city does not remove the question from the ballot. Convention and Visitors Bureau Executive Director Janet Halverson says their position is that the wording of the initiative violates Alaska statutes and the city's certification was improper.
It is unconstitutional, and the letter states the reasons why, and this was a board decision to take this action, feeling that it was in the best interest of our organization, its membership, and everyone involved.
Halverson says that according to Alaska statutes, the initiative cannot be used to dedicate revenues.
I think they're absolutely wrong.
ITA President Donna Gilbert, who doesn't agree with the Bureau, but says she also doesn't want the matter tied up in court. Gilbert wants it to go to voters. So she says if the problem is the word dedication being in the initiative, they'll change the wording. Gilbert is circulating a new petition now, hoping to get enough signatures in time to make it on the October ballot.
Well, it's really put us in kind of a bind, and I'm very, very disappointed in the Bureau. I think it's a matter that the people should have been able to vote on. We are not reallocating money, as they are also claiming. We are merely taking away a dedication, which was dedicated to them. I feel it very wrong that the Bureau is taking the taxpayers' money that was given to them to spend on tourism to come back and sue the city of Fairbanks with.
Gilbert says she's confident the city would win in court, but she doesn't want to wait for that. The ITA is now pushing to get the work done on time. A new petition must be in order by the end of next week. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
It's a phenomenal resource for businesses here in town. It's located in the downtown center. It's the Small Business Development Center. It's a part of the school designed to help businesses who either are trying to get started and need a resource and another ear to bounce ideas off of, or it's there as a resource for businesses that are having a challenge, that maybe have a squeak in their personnel department or a squeak in the financial analysis or having some cash flow concerns or marketing problems or whatever. And we've got consultants there that are there to help businesses work through those challenges and keep it pointed towards profit.
So it'll be a very out-on-the-table kind of planning process, which will start with the council itself, but then very, very quickly move to expand to include other agencies, but most important of all, the people of the city of Fairbanks as to what do they want Fairbanks to be. And I think I know the answer, at least partially, to that, to be a very good place to work, live, and bring up children.
So far, the Fairbanks City Council and the Fairbanks Metropolitan Area Transportation System Policy Committee are opposing the department's plan. They say projects important to the Fairbanks area will be delayed 1 or 2 years. Specifically, widening College Road would not happen until 1996. Also, some portions of the Johansson Expressway, which will eventually take Geist Road all the way through Fairbanks to the Steese Highway, have been delayed by 2 years. Department of Transportation officials want to hear from the public about the proposed changes. Chief of Planning and Research for the Northern Region, John Martin, says they expect some opposition any time some project is moved, but the DOT has to balance the needs throughout the region. Martin says they have to submit a plan next week to the commissioner's office. After that, it will go to the governor. So what is written down next week is pretty final, except for minor changes. And Martin says there will likely be changes from the latest draft.
We've deliberately not formulated a plan until we hear from everyone and lay all the comments out on the table, take a look at them, and determine what we can do. Some things we have scheduling problems in terms of our ability to produce a project from a technical perspective, and we simply cannot advance projects the way people ask. For other projects, we have some maneuvering room, and some of the comments make sense. Actually, most of them make sense. It's just strictly a limited budget. We have a lot more projects and pressing needs than we have money for.
The proposal outlines how to spend $50 million for each of the next 6 years. Martin says the public comment period is important. If there is a lot of vocal support to advance one project, the project that no one has commented on may be sacrificed in order to balance the plan and work on the things that have a lot of support. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Well, for many reasons, it's getting the closest to the planet. I am personally interested in its magnetic environment and the radiation environment. That's my own research field. But of course, I am also interested in the images that the spacecraft is beginning to send back from the atmosphere of the planet.
This is the slowest run on record, and they're not expected to arrive into Fairbanks between noon and 1. And the reason being is there's a lot of new people on the run this year. We normally have some very fast runners that will even out that time, even when we have some slow runners. But this year, a lot of our really fast people were injured before the run and not able to go. So we have a really good team this year. They're wonderful. They're doing great. There's no injuries. However, they're just not quite as fast as some of the people we've had before, so we're just going to be rolling in quite a bit later than expected.
Studies show that Alaska's university professors continue to make more money than the national average. One expert says that's not necessarily good news for those teaching at Alaska's universities. Chris Kirby has more on the American Association of University Professors report on salaries.
According to the study, the average full professor at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks earns $57,000 a year. At University of Alaska at Anchorage, $52,700 a year. And at Alaska Pacific University, $47,800 annually. That compares to the national average of $50,000 a year. The association's Ernie Benjamin says the numbers may look good for Alaska's professors, but the situation is bad.
The faculty members who are full professors tend to have not to compare as well nationally as do the lower ranks. Clearly what's happened is that the cost of living is so high in Alaska that they've had to try to give fairly generous salaries to the lowest ranked faculty so that they can get by, but the result is that the senior faculty tend not to be paid as well relative to other faculty across the country.
Benjamin says Alaska's location also makes it difficult for Alaska's universities to recruit and keep good professors.
It costs people quite a bit, of course, if they want to fly somewhere to do research and to participate in professional conferences, so that has to be supported. It makes it more difficult, really, to be part of the academic mainstream, and if you have to do that on a narrow salary margin, it's, of course, all the harder.
Benjamin admits many professors choose Alaska because they enjoy the state's uniqueness. But he says with its high cost of living and remote location, Alaska faces more obstacles attracting good professors than most other states. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Chris Kirby in Washington, D.C.
Members of the state's Science and Technology Foundation were in Nome this week, making the final cut on a stack of requests for state money for schemes to expand Alaska's economic base. Paul Korchin has this report.
Joe Seibert, the executive director of the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation, wants there to be no mistake about the new organization's reason and role for existing.
We are not another way to pump money into the university, for example. We're not another funding agency for the university, though we will consider and have considered our university projects. On the other hand, we're also not a small business association loaning startup money for someone to start a service business. It has to have some fundamental impact on the state, and that's our approach to what we're doing.
What the nine-member board of directors did during their meeting Monday and Tuesday in Nome was to decide which proposals will receive initial funding and which ones will go back to the drawing board. Seibert says the 100-odd proposals the board was presented with requested more than $31 million for their economic development projects. He says the foundation has about one-tenth of that figure available for grants this year. As a result, the board has spent the past few weeks carefully evaluating reviews of each proposal, whittling the list down to the ones that will get the bucks.
They voted on that first 105 proposals, and of the first 105, 10 of them were approved for funding. That means, and these covered fisheries, forestry, rural energy, community and economic development, and mining. So it covered a number of the fields. That does not, these totaled in amount of dollars around $730,000 requested.
Seibert says the next step is for the foundation to negotiate specific contracts with the 10 proposers. In his words, for these things to work, you just don't give the money and walk away from it.
I would hope we'd see, I hope there's a kind of thing we can show, and this first group of proposals strongly indicates that that's what we'll be able to do, that we are leveraging state funds with private funds and federal funds to get a lot of bang for the buck.
Seibert declined to elaborate on what kind of actual projects will result from the proposals approved, as contracts have yet to be finalized. The Science and Technology Foundation was created by the 88-89 legislature at the urging of Governor Cooper and others who want Alaska to become more competitive in fields related to business technology. Seibert says the foundation was given a $6 million appropriation up front, plus a $34 million endowment from which the foundation is allowed to draw the interest. He says as things stand now, the foundation expects to have $2 to $3 million a year for funding purposes. Seibert says the foundation plans to vote on funding proposals three times a year. Reporting in Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
A small group of supporters greeted the Alaska State Troopers running for Special Olympics as they came into Fairbanks yesterday. Just before 1 o'clock, the relay team passed the Captain Bartlett Inn, local headquarters for the event. The troopers are hoping to raise $100,000 for Special Olympics by running more than 1,000 miles between Skagway and Anchorage. This is the 11th year the Alaska State Troopers have held the Special Olympics run. 31-year-old Trooper Cindy Pollitt was the first female runner back in 1986 and ran the leg through Fairbanks yesterday. A veteran in her third sum run now, Pollitt had no complaints as she headed into town.
It's been really good, real good. Good weather, good people supporting me along the way. Communities have been really good with us. It makes me real happy.
Runners take 8-mile segments in rotation, passing off a baton to the next runner like a relay race. Each trooper will run about 11 times during the course of the week-long trip. The run is going more slowly than expected. Wind in Canada over the weekend slowed them down. They also are taking a completely new and longer route than in previous years. Communities around the state are raising money by letting people guess the finish time of the run. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornton.
Well, the money damage is one thing, and a good company can recover from that. But I think that what will be lasting in people's minds in the future is to what it says about management, the capability of management to have a long-term, forward-looking strategy. Because if you just have caretakers, brilliant though they may be, technologically sound though they may be, if they're not looking at the future, that company eventually is going to fall in the middle of the pack. It's not going to be a leader. Just because you're big today, as Detroit found out in the 70s, doesn't mean you're going to be big tomorrow. There are always going to be people nipping at your heels.
the service that might suffer will be, you know, the communications and the training and the development of the postmasters in the villages. And because of the distances between some of our villages and Anchorage and communication problems, I suspect that there are going to be difficulties. But it's not impossible to manage.
3, 2, 1. It's not a full-time job or a full commitment to the military, but the Air National Guard does offer the chance to fly. Not as fighter pilots, their jobs are sort of like being service station attendants in a giant gasoline pump in the sky. The Air Guardsman's primary responsibility in the air is refueling the fuel tanks of the smaller fighter planes. Most of them only carry enough fuel to fly for about 2 hours. The KC-135 tanker, which is a militarized version of the Boeing 707, carries more than 65,000 pounds of fuel. It will send a couple thousand pounds to each of the 810s that are flying on the maneuvers today. The tanker flies in circles until the smaller planes are ready to be gassed up. Its altitude depends on the plane it's refueling. Today it will climb to about 16,000 feet. The 810s don't go as high or as fast as some of the other fighters the crew refuels. The people who actually do the refueling are called boom operators. They have a small pit in the tail of the plane where they lay down on their stomachs and guide the long gas hose nozzle to the tank of the smaller planes. It's a wonderful vantage point during aerial refueling. The boom operator is only about 20 feet above the nose of the plane below. Mark McGrath is one of two boom operators on this trip.
He gets 50 feet back and he says, okay, I'm stable, ready to come in. And I said, all right, everything looks good, come on in. I turn on the light under the nose of the airplane and he starts coming in. I can do it either talking verbally or with just the lights. He lines up on the center of the airplane. Here comes the other flight right below us. So we have these mirrors so we can see who's out there moving around. Right now this light tells me we're in contact physically. These gauges tell me where he can be in the little envelope out here.
How long does this take to do?
Well, depends how much gas they're going to take. These guys are only taking 2,000 pounds, which is 400 or 500 gallons, if that. So it won't take very long.
The Air Guard unit that operates out of Eielson Air Force Base will be 3 years old this fall. With four airplanes, they have about 250 people in the Guard unit, but they soon will have 8 planes and expect to double the number of guardsmen. Most of those jobs will be for part-time workers. Mike Sloan is chief recruiter and says part-time work has its benefits. He says pay, travel opportunities, and educational benefits are all worthwhile.
You can go to training and you get to come back to Alaska and serve your entire enlistment here 1 week in a month, 2 weeks annual training each year. The advantage to that is you can still pursue your college education on a full-time basis, or you can continue into your regular civilian job, and that's the big advantage to it.
Guardsmen spend most of the time in training. In fact, that's what they do, train and train until they might actually be called into action by the Strategic Air Command. With 6 crews now, the 168th Squadron hopes to have as many as 20. A new hangar is also being built for the Air Guard at Eielson. Officials are quick to point out that the Air Force is shrinking, but the Guard is growing. The U.S. military is reducing its costs by relying more and more on the Air Guard to do the job that it can do efficiently. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornton. Three, two, one. The Yakutians found out just how much you can do in 9 days. Officials with the Fairbanks North Star Borough organized very busy schedules for the Russian visitors so they could learn as much about Fairbanks as possible in the sister city courtship process. They left with good impressions of Fairbanks. Alexei Tomtasov is a member of the High Soviet. Tomtasov believes Northerners in both countries have common characteristics. They are hospitable, polite, and their Arctic locations are very similar. He's been to the United States before, but says through a translator that he has noticed some changes.
In the sphere of civil rights,
этнических и расовых отношений,
in ethnic and racial relations,
изменения в лучшую сторону.
Changes have been for the better.
Ну и вот в связи с перестройкой в Советском Союзе.
Relating to perestroika in the Soviet Union.
Резко изменилось отношение общества и американского народа к нашему обществу и к нашему народу.
There have been drastic changes in the relations between the people of America, society in America, and the society and people of the Soviet Union.
И мне кажется, еще и заметно вот бросается в глаза, что американцы стали меньше курить.
And it's very noticeable, extremely noticeable, that Americans have begun to smoke much less.
И, по-моему, значительно укрепилось антиалкогольное сознание. Укрепилось.
It seems that also to me that the anti-alcoholism campaigns have been considerably strengthened.
Это заметно.
But this is quite noticeable.
Another of the Soviets in town was Yakutsk Mayor Pavel Borodin. Borodin is looking forward to the exchanges that the two cities can have.
We will undoubtedly start with so-called cultural exchanges, meaning student exchanges, artistic exchanges, and sportive exchanges.
Ну я думаю, что также в ближайшие год-два мы установим отношения по бизнесу.
But we are also convinced that in the next two or three years we will establish cooperative business relationships.
Конечно, у нас и у вас много проблем, связанных с таможней, связанных с приграничными отношениями, с транспортной сложной схемой.
Both on your side and on our side we have many existing problems, particularly as they concern transportation, taxation, and so forth. But if people want to work together cooperatively, as you and I do, then all of these difficulties will be meaningless.
The Soviet visitors got some shopping in their last day. Their flight for New York left at 12:30 this morning. The visit was part of the process of establishing a possible sister city relationship with the Fairbanks North Star borough. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornton.
But I don't think we're going to be able to do it. There's too much vested interest there. The incumbents have an enormous advantage at the moment, so it would make that advantage less obvious, and so people are probably not too enthusiastic about it if they're elected officials. But I think that everybody else ought to take a look at it. I think everybody else is going to like it.